we need to have the best range of people that can bring their minds to bear on the problem. A whole range of backgrounds, of ways of thinking, of ways of looking at things. We are absolutely on the lookout to bring a broad range of people in, and then, crucially, ensure that the environment means that they can do their best, and actually we can bring the best out of them. One of the things that has stuck with me over many years, a wise coach actually, who said, manage your energy rather than your time. You can look at your diary and all that, but the real thing is managing energy. We're perhaps not as quite as good as we should be at actually getting that recognition and thanks passed back to people. But I do think it's critically important. And just that tiny gestures of saying thank you to people, allowing people to see the value of what they're doing, for me is really important.
Adrian Bird is the first non-military Chief of Defence Intelligence. He leads a technically capable, operationally focused organisation constantly dealing with matters of national security, full of remarkable people quietly committed to keeping our country safe. You won't be surprised to learn that Adrian is enormously thoughtful and phenomenally bright, but I think you'll be encouraged by his candour and his preparedness to discuss what defence intelligence, or DI as it's known, does. Today, Adrian delves into what he thinks good leadership looks like. I recommend you have a pen and paper ready to capture the multiple insights and quotations that I know are coming, including the surprising relevance of the 1989 film Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Adrian.
Defence Intelligence is Defence's intelligence organisation. So we are involved in all aspects of intelligence work, from collection of intelligence to analysis to what we call all source assessment. So trying to answer the significant questions about what's going on and what might happen. And we're also involved in operations as well. So for example, counterintelligence. So it's a full range of activities. We work very closely with our other partners in the UK. In fact, our history goes back in quite an intertwined way. DI can draw its history right back to the Crimean War. It was the Topography and Statistical Department. As you might know, in World War One, you had all of the MI numbers. So to this day, we have MI5 and MI6. But of course, then you had all the other military intelligence branches. We're pretty good at it, but for obvious reasons, we can't talk about the details of what we do.
You lead a complex, technically capable, operationally focused organization. What do you enjoy most about your job?
I think what we do, and throughout my career in national security and intelligence, is just really important. And I'd always known that I'd wanted to work in public service, didn't want to go into the private sector. And as I joined the intelligence community, the first thing is it's just super important work. And therefore, I feel a huge both duty, but actually also satisfaction in helping to keep the country safe, really. But actually, on top of that, the thing that really gets me out of bed is the people. I really enjoy working with people. I always knew, again, I wanted to work with people in teams. And the people in defence intelligence are brilliant. It's a real inspiration.
That combining of both your purpose and your passion, I mean, so early on is something that many people in their world of work don't get to do. And to be working with others who clearly are motivated in a similar way must be really rewarding.
Yeah, very much so. There's a whole set of elements there. I mean, clearly, the world of work that we are in, and the world, as you know, is a dangerous place, and the threats are out there. That requires that sort of often a problem-solving approach. And so I found over the years, and certainly within DI, that having an ability to work with people in teams doing often analytic or technical problem-solving is both really important and very motivating. And if in that, A, we're able to have effects so that we're actually able to keep the country safe or whatever we need to do, that's really motivating. But also, inherently working with brilliant people, I just learn so much every day. So I guess I'm lucky. Yeah, it's inspiring work.
And for people who work in this world where reward is often done quietly and without public recognition, how is that different and how do you manage that?
The first thing I'd say would be that recognition is really important. And you're right that in defence intelligence, in the intelligence community generally, we're just not able to be broadcasting what we do. And we aren't in the same game as many others that you can have that easy public recognition. But I do believe that pretty much for most, well, the great majority of individuals, knowing that you've done a good job, getting that recognition from whether your peers or your bosses or your community or your department, it is really important. And I'd say that often, certainly within DI and possibly within the wider community, we're perhaps not as quite as good as we should be at actually getting that recognition and thanks passed back to people. But I do think it's critically important. And just that tiny gestures of saying thank you to people, allowing people to see the value of what they're doing, for me is really important.
And working in an operationally focused, busy role and environment, one of the first things that sometimes happens is people forget to take the time to do that. And that then has a negative impact on the culture of the wider organization. What does good leadership look like to you?
Yeah, so that's a big old question. So how to answer that? So I think for me, the first thing to say is that I think leadership is situational, first off. So it depends upon the situation you're in. I genuinely don't think that there is a single model for this, but I do think that there are particular behaviours that, at least in my opinion, are really good at being able to help motivate people or to actually get a job done. And when I talk about leadership, I'm thinking about the things that need to happen, but perhaps wouldn't happen unless somebody was taking that step forward. So I think there's a number of different behaviours in there that come out. You know, one of them absolutely is recognising what people in the team have done. It's the right thing to do. It sort of gives credit where it's due. It's motivating. I really believe, you know, catch people doing it right, as opposed to, in a sense, trying to find fault. Because I think then you are hopefully building on success and you're reinforcing that. That's one dimension. But I mean, there's a whole wider range of issues that play in.
I read that you're a big fan of the 1989 film, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. It's something of a cult film, and hopefully this might get others from the new generations watching it. For those that haven't seen it, can you tell us why it landed so well with you?
Well, I'm shocked that people haven't seen it, for a start, because it's a real gem of a film. Okay, so the two-sentence synopsis, so on one level, it's a buddy time-travelling historical adventure. So two Californian teenagers. It was Keanu Reeves' breakthrough movie. Keanu Reeves and his buddy travel through time, recruiting historical figures to bring back for their history report. So on one level, it's a sort of time-travelling romp. It's well-written, it's funny, and on one level I was attracted to it, because who wouldn't like a movie with Keanu Reeves and, you know, Socrates, Genghis Khan, Napoleon, you know, Joan of Arc? Why it stuck with me? At the end of the movie, Abraham Lincoln gives a speech. It's a bit of a bowdlerised Gettysburg Address, but he ends it with saying, "Be excellent to each other." And he then says, "And party on, dudes," because it's kind of funny, be excellent to each other. And that phrase has really stuck with me, because in a sense, it just sums up really well just an ethos about how to treat people. And it's really stuck with me because it's true. And I think from a moral point of view, it's absolutely the right thing to do. And also, certainly in the work that I've been doing for the last 32 years or so, it's a thing that makes a difference. So yes, there's the thing, I highly recommend the movie, but I really recommend the sentiment.
It goes to the values as well. And in defence intelligence, you have, I think, four values: courage, candour, creativity and community. Were you involved in the design and development of that, or have you brought it in to be aligned with, be excellent to each other?
A bit of the reverse, really. So in fact, my predecessor with his team set those values. For me, though, they are very true and very apposite. And my own sort of, if you like, that kind of personal motto from Bill and Ted fits very well. A lot of what we do within defence intelligence is around that sort of old truism of needing to tell truth to power. So hence the elements there on candor. You know, we exist not to give a picture that is the world as people would like it to be, but to really try to get a sense of what's going on and why is that significant and what's going to happen. Very often, to do that in a way that is proper and appropriate takes courage. A lot of what we deal with is pretty grim. So just actually doing that work day on day takes courage to do it. But it's certainly about candor. And I find, you know, whether that's myself briefing ministers or senior officials or the team or right down to our most junior folks, that candor is really prized. But of course, as I said earlier on, a lot of it is problem solving, trying to find out the information in the first place, doing that appropriately, and that requires creativity and a big thing about community. So for me, that plays again into how we have an environment which is psychologically safe, how we have some environment where we are able to bring people together. So it's got to be done in a way that is inclusive. And that is also brilliant for developing a sense of community. Because as you said earlier on, a lot of this community, you know, is necessarily not in the limelight and can't get always that public recognition.
Of course, there's so much in there. I think one of the worst things about the British military and defence is that we're very quick to forget things. And Rommel said that the British write the best doctrine in the world. Thank God they don't read it. And there's a great little pamphlet called The Good Operation, which was written by Chilcot in the aftermath of the Iraq inquiry. There is a reasonable challenge guide. And I presume that one of the things you have as your almost, well, as a reference document, you have that in your, in the candor part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm really proud that not only our organisation has it, but all those people involved in the profession, because it is a profession, of that intelligence assessment is something that is absolutely prized. Many of us in our offices or rooms will have a Chilcot checklist mm-hmm. up on the walls. And I think that the way in which the community has evolved to essentially learn significant lessons from things such as the Butler Review and then the Chilcot Review has really enshrined that importance of challenge. Whether you see this in the meetings of the Joint Intelligence Committee or whether it's within Defence Intelligence, what we try to do, and I do think we live up to it, is to enshrine that challenge in there. But of course, it also means that it's incumbent upon us to make that as effective as possible. So it would be absolutely no good in us saying, right, really important to challenge, but then give every impression that we did not welcome challenge, and in fact, actually, it was to the detriment of individuals to raise it. It's a hard balance, but I do think that for us in the community, it's so important to what we do.
And having that breadth and range of views also is vital. I remember Matthew Saeed in Rebel Ideas talked about how the CIA had blind spots because of who it was attracting to join. And so presumably you're also trying to recruit from a range of different backgrounds and people. But once you've done that, back to your inclusivity point, you want to be able to create the conditions in the culture where their voices can be heard.
Absolutely. So yes, we need to have a genuinely broad range of talents and minds in this business, because, as I said, it's inherently difficult. We are in a world where we are having to every day try and outsmart people who, frankly, are seeking to do harm to our people and the country. So the stakes are quite high. So consequently, in that, we need to have the best range of people that can bring their minds to bear on the problem. And that includes, as you say, a whole range of backgrounds, of ways of thinking, of ways of looking at things. We are absolutely on the lookout to bring a broad range of people in. And then, crucially, ensure that the environment means that they can do their best, and actually we can bring the best out of them. So that is a whole, again, a range of stuff from the very micro things about how it is that we interact together, from meetings through to briefings, all of that. And then also thinking about what does it mean more broadly in the organisation? How do people experience it? But you're right, it's both a morally important thing to do, back to the be excellent to each other, but it's also a kind of brutally important business thing to do. If we don't do that, we will miss things. And that's happened in the past.
Maybe there's a sequel to Bill and Ted's final phrase, which is not just be excellent to each other, but as a result, be excellent for the country. I think that links neatly to the purpose of your organisation. You talked about the difficulty of the kind of work that you're doing. You talked about it being grim. One of the things you also mentioned about was psychological safety. And I suspect the combination of the kind of work you do, but also the imperative have psychological safety is really important.
Yes. So if I unpack those elements, they are really important. I think about it a lot, actually, in this role. Generally, it's funny, the anecdote here would be going into meetings with ministers or senior officials. And usually the kind of comments I'll get in jest will be, oh God, you know, what are you coming to tell me? Or some variant of that. Because on the whole, we're not always able to say, unalloyed good news today, CDS. It's usually not the case. There is then something for all of us involved in intelligence work, which is recognising that, you know, what we're dealing, as I said, can be quite unremittingly grim, particularly when within that we have analysts and folks who are even more exposed to material that is disturbing in whatever way. So there's a big thing there about how we have that kind of psychological safety and that wrapper around people. You then have all the issues about the pressures in an organisation. You know, we don't have all the resources that we need. Nobody does these days. People are working very hard in their own home lives. It's, you know, times are tough. So I think all of that comes in as well. So for me, how we are able to frame a working environment that, of course, has absolutely the high standards, that mission focus, that, you know, kind of unremitting focus on the problems, but doing it in a way that allows people not to feel that when they're in the meeting, they're actually under additional pressure, or worse, that they are somehow going to be censured or, you know, kind of criticized for speaking up, or they don't feel safe to do so. It's really important to do. When it's all panicked, if you're in the stress, keeping calm and that sort of regulation is also very key to do that too.
And the relentless nature of the world of work that you're in also must make it very important for people to have the opportunity to recover and recuperate. How do you manage that?
There's a personal thing and there's an organisational thing. For me, and I think for the top team in DI, it's about really recognising that. If a crisis comes about, and sadly they do, and we have lots of these sorts of events, written into our kind of operating procedures, we'll be thinking immediately about, okay, not so much who needs to surge on to that crisis, but who do we need to send home now so that they can recover to be ready, etc. So there's a sort of set of stuff that is hardwired in. I think there's a lot of signalling that we do, which again is really enshrining, really kind of focusing in on the importance of people taking their leave and us all in leadership positions leading by example and communicating that. Being able to celebrate the fact that people have lives outside work. Occasionally people do work long hours. It can be a requirement, especially on the operational side. But that's not a kind of badge of honour. On a personal point of view, again, one of the things that has stuck with me over many years, a wise coach actually who said, manage your energy rather than your time. You know, you can look at your diary and all that, but the real thing is managing energy. For me, then, it's back to that, okay, how are you resilient in this? And a whole set of stuff then around getting enough sleep, trying to do exercise and all of that, but also finding mechanisms to be able to put the stress and the work stress in a kind of context and to deal with it, if that makes sense.
I mean, I love that, managing your energy. That's brilliant. I've definitely worked in the army in parts of the organisation where that badge of honour of doing long hours and actually not to be effective because you've worked such long hours has been definitely a badge of honour. One of the things that we haven't yet talked about is around the negative aspects of poor workplace culture and bad behaviours. And really what I'm talking about is either bullying, harassment, or more broadly, people talk about workplace incivility.
So I'll start with a sort of a belief. I believe that the vast majority of people in workplaces, and certainly within defence intelligence or within defence, etc., are genuinely good people and want to do a good job. In any big organisation, you're bound to, the statistics say that you've probably got a couple of psychopaths, but generally, the vast majority of people, I think, want to do a good job. A lot of what's driving people to behave in certain ways is the situation they're in, or the way in which they feel they need to get their needs met, or whatever it will be. When we know it happens, because within defence, as in other areas, the incidence of recorded harassment and bullying is far too high. I mean, anything is high, but when you're looking at sort of, you know, 10, 12%, whatever, that's far too high. So I genuinely don't believe that what we have is a bunch of people who are seeking to behave badly. But I do think often the way in which we are able to see how the organisation can help people cope with the stresses they're under, how we set the norms for how we interact with each other, makes that maybe more likely. So yes, you know, there will be times when people really do behave in a way that is inconsolable and then action needs to be taken. But I think there is something about setting up good habits for how we operate. So to try and bring that to life a bit, at the moment within DI, we've been having another push, because we have these periodically, on things like behaviours in meetings. So what's the first duty of the chair of the meeting? Make everybody there feel safe. Because if you don't do that as a chair, how are you able to bring out all the benefits and all the talents that you have in the room? And that requires a certain set of behaviours to do that. They are eminently learnable. But I think those kind of things get at this issue of bullying and harassment But it's also noting that we in DI and more broadly won't tolerate that. And if it comes to the fact that people do not become competent at this, it's then the action you take. So it's a real mixture, I think. But I think the powerful thing is actually that there is a way to do this, which is and should be positive for everybody.
And that role modelling of good behaviours that you've talked about in a hierarchical organisation is even more important in some ways, because if you have in the room amazing brains with insight and knowledge that's critical to finding the solution that's needed for the particular problem you have, if you don't have that safety established, they might be sitting in a back row and not have the confidence to contribute, even at a critical moment. And presumably that's at the heart of why you're trying to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's one of those areas where treating people with respect and being a nice human being absolutely coincides with what the business needs to do. So increasingly within defence and certainly within DI, you know, when we have meetings, beginning of the meetings, we'll be wanting everybody in the room, whether they're at the table or around the back, to introduce themselves or to know who's there. Because often, again, it can be quite intimidating. And I've gone to meetings where I've sort of thought, wow, you know, am I safe to speak up? Because you're maybe not quite sure who's in the room. Little things that you can do to begin to set the conditions. And then to your point about hierarchies, yeah, of course, your hierarchies are important. There's an accountability thing. What roles are there? What are we paid to do? But I think then it's different with regard to hierarchical behavior. If you're behaving in a way which is not, if you like, in service to what you're trying to achieve and to your teams, that can get toxic quite quickly. So being alive to that and then looking at how you signal that, I think, is important.
Quite often that's done unwittingly. I mean, people aren't, as you say, doing it deliberately. But it often just needs someone to point that out, either at the time or afterwards. But that still requires some degree of courage, I think, to do that.
Yes. I think back to a time a few years ago. It was a meeting with, a very, very senior official. I won't do names, but a briefing given by a colleague. And the very, very senior official I knew had just got off a plane and were exhausted. They were listening, but they were listening pretty much with their heads sort of more or less on the desk and what have you. And afterwards, the colleague who'd done the briefing had come up to me and said, should I tender my resignation now? Because clearly that briefing was the, you know, I was able then to say, well, no, of course not. The individual was very tired. But then, yes, do you have a culture where you can go back and say to the big boss, actually, no, you're very tired, but the impact of that on this individual was quite difficult. I think that was because that boss had created that feedback loop. And I'd hope that, for me, people would do that. I know, you know, on a good day, I can do these things. On a bad day, you know, you can lapse. But I think it's really important to get that feedback.
Yes, and I've often been in a room where I thought, should I say something or should the more senior person say something? And actually, it would be wonderful if that reticence wasn't there, because you were doing it because you knew it was the right thing to do and not complicating it by other factors. What do you do to relax?
A number of things. We still have kids at home. So for me, a big part of my relaxation is sort of family stuff. Even the dad taxi driving thing is nice to spend time with them. For the geeks out there, I occasionally like a bit of a League of Legends game with the teenagers, which is always good. I like to run, partly the resilience thing. I find that very good to both keep fit and just to have that decompression. My hobby, although I don't have as much time for hobbies as I'd like, I like to play board games, again with the family. Not so much Monopoly, but the kind of more European-style board games. And I, for many years, have collected and painted toy soldiers, because I'm very into military history. I think it's something that is physical, as an antidote to reading the stacks of paper.
Does your soldier collection have a theme? Maybe sailors and aviators as well, I don't know. Does it have a theme to it?
My wife will tell you she is depressed at the number of very small Napoleonic toy soldiers I own. As a classicist, it was my university background, I've always been into ancient history. So I have a lot of kind of Romans and Greeks and Egyptians and what have you. But for me, it's really the painting. Yes. I enjoy doing. And my midlife crisis is I took up snowboarding a few years ago.
Oh, did
as well.
You?
So as a,
and have you been injury free?
Happily so. Happily so.
Well, long may that continue.
Indeed.
One of the questions I sometimes ask is whether guests have a favourite quotation that they use that they find relevant in the workplace or beyond.
Yes, there are a number of things I have, if you like, tattooed on the inside of my head that I just found very helpful over the years. One that I find myself saying quite a lot in work is a variant on being right is not the same as being effective. on the basis that, especially if we are dealing with complex situations, often I found remembering that, you know, we can be as right as we like, but that's not the same then as actually being effective in what we need to do. And so for me, that's been a useful way of both validating, yeah, you know, we are right on this, this is the thing, but then what do we then need to do to get the mission outcome or to actually achieve what we need to do? So that's been a thing. I came across this one. Now, this is courtesy of Professor Keith Grint, who I think is now at Warwick. We did a module on negotiation skills. He made the point that power is a relationship, not a possession. And the more I think about this over the years, the more I think that's just super wise. On the basis of, unless we are a dictator holding a gun to somebody's head, you know, people have a choice. And so nominally, yes, in this role, it's a pretty powerful role, but it's not a possession I own. The ability to discharge that role is really about the relationships that I'll have. And so for me, that's been really important because it plays back into how is it that we are able to lead, and leaders have to have followers, and the relationships then evolve and change. And very often I found in my career that it's often a longer term game than you think. Actually, investing in relationships will often pay back years and years in the future.
Gosh, that's so brilliant. And I've never heard that before. And I'm thinking, how is that possible, particularly in having served for 30 plus years in the army, where the responsibility that leaders have oftentimes is framed through the lens of the power that you have, rather than the relationship, but also the imperative to get the discretionary effort from your people. And if you talk about it in that context or that way, then it totally blows apart how you have a relationship with everyone, let alone with those that are directly in your team. You talk about the long term. I was an instructor at Sandhurst years ago, and there are things that I probably did then that I think, God, I could have been kinder or better or more thoughtful to the officer cadets that I was interacting with. Now, they're all way more senior than I am. I hadn't thought that through. I mean, I was trying to be as good as I could be. But if I had known that then, I would have been such a better leader from a much earlier age.
I just think it's a truism. And in the defence and intelligence world, it's quite a small world in many ways. That sense of thinking about all these relationships are important. It doesn't really matter, I think, whether it's with regard to bosses or seniors or peers or people that you are managing or leading or commanding in a military context. But as you say, it's discretionary effort. It is different to some extent as a civil servant as opposed to a military leader. But I think some of the principles of really being able to understand your team, how they are motivated, what they want, how they're able to contribute more, because usually that's what they're trying to do, and then be able to respond to that is really key. And it also is just that much more fulfilling, because I want to work in a place where you have good relationships with people and it's fun and there's a sort of rapport. I wouldn't want to work somewhere that was not doing that.
And that's particularly true when you're working in a whole workforce environment where people have come from very different backgrounds and working environments where you're constructed into this great team, but the way in which you apply yourselves and execute your activity must be tempered by the environment you're working in.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, situational leadership thing, there's obviously so many models on leadership and kind of run out. But if you are in a situation of a crisis or a fire or what have you, you're not into co-creation. You're into, right, get out, you now. And there'll be times when we are doing, I don't know, crisis management or operational management, where necessarily what we need to do as the leaders will be that much more directive. But of course, that's completely inappropriate if you're trying to do other things where you're wanting to bring out problem solving or whatever it will be. So I think that situational aspect is really important. I think the other thing that I found really important in this job and previous jobs is the topic of collaborative leadership or systems leadership. That's been something that I've really wanted to focus in on with top teams and try to navigate through, because I think there's often a tension between leaders who rightly are accountable for things, and very often we then try to divide that up and focus in on our thing. But the problem is that generally life is more complex than that. And there are other leaders trying to do their things, certainly for defence intelligence, where I noted we do a whole range of stuff, the danger is we can fragment into a number of different stovepipes or baronies or whatever analogy you like. So for me, I think there's something really interesting in how to develop that kind of collaborative or systems leadership, whereby, of course, there is an accountability for you achieving the outcomes that you're set to achieve. But at the same time, it's how do the collective leadership optimize that organization to deal with all the things we're dealing with? And I'm really interested in that, partly because it's really important, because often I think where things don't work so well is where we are only able to optimize on certain things and you don't get that benefit. But it's also really difficult, because the ability to do that, how do you foster an environment whereby people are able to, in some cases, compromise, see that there's a bigger win, even though it might not be in their area, if you, in some cases, sell that back to their own people. It's a difficult thing.
Do you think that there's sufficient training and education of how to do that in the professional development work that is done?
There's a lot of, I think, very good leadership and associated training. One thing that I think probably, and I'd say I'm guilty of this within DI, is in a sense not as yet having stood back and saying, okay, when you look at all this, what do we then have as that pathway for individuals, whether it's kind of coming up through initial leadership or management roles through to the senior roles? If I was to say, well, what would be in the syllabus? I think that all the elements pretty much exist, whether it's in the military leadership training or the civil service leadership training. But certainly I haven't in DI stepped back and said, you know, what would be that syllabus? Well, a lot of organizational psychology things really come into it, where an understanding of how broadly human beings behave in a certain way is very helpful to know. But yeah, you know, you prompted me now to actually think about, you know, what's our offer within DI there? But it's out there, but it's not cohered perhaps.
Adrian didn't come to the recording with the intention of recruiting people to join DI, but I left the studio wishing that I was part of his team doing purposeful work that tells truth to power. What stood out for me was his determination to create psychological safety to ensure that everyone is able to contribute their very best. This is clearly mission critical for DI and anyone involved in optimizing operational effectiveness. I was also struck by Adrian's flowers of wisdom. I wish I was 20 when I heard, manage your energy, not your time. And I absolutely loved, power is a relationship, not a possession. I'd love to know what surprised you, and not just Adrian taking up snowboarding. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. And please share this episode with leaders who you know want to be excellent to everyone. Take care until next time.